by Professor Ora John Reuter. It's Political Machines at Work, Voter Mobilization and Electoral Subversion in the Russian Workplace. And I think many people know John Reuter, but he is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, so fellow Scotty here. And he also holds an appointment as Senior Researcher at the Center for the Study of Institutions and Development at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. And he's a PhD in political science from Emory University, former student of our friend Tom Remington. That's right,
right? That's right.
And his research focuses on elections, political parties, democratization, political economy, and Russian politics. Currently, work on a book manuscript on the origins of ruling parties in non-democracy. So thank you for coming and joining me in welcoming Professor Reuter.
Great, yes, thanks for having me. Thanks for that very nice introduction. So today I'm going to talk to you about a project that I've been working on with David Chaconian and Tim Fry about how politicians and employers put pressure on employees during elections in places like Russia. One question I think this project can give us an insight into is how autocrats win elections. So in comparative politics, there's been a lot of work recently that's shown us that holding semi-competitive elections provides autocrats with certain benefits, whether it's gathering information or relieving social pressures. So one question is, well, how do autocrats win these elections without resorting to heavy-handed repression or just faking the election results completely, which would be akin to not holding the elections and not receiving the benefits? Well, there's lots of ways they win elections, but one thing that we're trying to do in this project is explore one underappreciated, we think, underexplored way that autocrats try to win elections, which is by inducing employers to mobilize their employees, often via intimidation or pressure, to turn out and vote for the regime at election time. And specifically, one thing that we're interested in, I should say this is part of a broader book project, and this is kind of one component that I'm going to talk about today. And the specific component I want to talk about is why this happens in some settings, but not others. And specifically, why it happens in some firms in Russia, but not others. So I'm just going to talk really, I'm just going to kind of motivate this issue really, really briefly at the beginning. And then I'm going to talk for a good chunk today. I'm just going to talk about this practice and what it looks like in Russia. So I'm going to show you some survey data that we have about how this practice is carried out in Russia, just paint a picture of the practice. And then I'm going to talk very, very briefly about our argument for why it happens in some settings but not others. And here we're going to look at two dependent relationships that are important. One, the dependency of employees on their employers, and two, the potential dependency of employers on the state or on the autocrat. And then I'll walk through some data that we use to test our argument and talk about the results. So this question. So how do autocrats win elections if they're not going to just fake all the results? How do they mobilize voters in particular? Well, one solution is to mobilize them by a political party. This is how politicians mobilize voters in democracies, and for a long time, this is people thought in closed autocracies, this is the way that autocrats also mobilize support. So, you know, you think of Marxist-Lenin-style regimes, they're engaged in perpetual agitation and propaganda, constant and thoroughgoing politicization of the electorate. Well, that's, you know, we know that happened, but politicizing the electorate can be dangerous in regimes that hold elections, because the danger for autocrats is if you politicize the electorate, they might make ideological investments in opposition parties, which is the last thing these dictators and electoral authoritarian regimes want. So rather, what you see is dictators and electoral authoritarian regimes, they try to sow so apathy in the electorate. So if you're not going to mobilize voters programmatically with a party, another way you can use a party is to mobilize voters clientelistically, that is to offer them some specific inducements in exchange for their vote. And some literature in political science has argued that parties are really good at facilitating this type of exchange because they help those who want to buy votes solve a commitment problem that's inherent in clientelist exchange. This commitment problem is that if a politician offers a voter some inducement in exchange for the vote, what is to keep the voter from accepting the inducement and then turning around and not voting in the way that the politician wants them to? So parties can solve this monitoring problem, this commitment problem, by helping the politician monitor the voting behavior of voters. So specifically, parties that are embedded in social in voters' social networks. So that's true. We know that's true in a lot of settings. But one thing to point out is that this requires really stringent assumptions about the strength of party organization at the grassroots level. You have to have cells that are penetrating people's social networks at a low level. But what we know is that, of course, parties in many electoral authoritarian regimes are actually really quite weak, especially weak at the grassroots level. So what's an alternative if you have a setting where you have weak parties that can't penetrate people's social networks at the grassroots levels? Well, one alternative is to co-opt existing elites in society, patrons who sit atop pre-existing clientelist networks, and have them mobilize voters for you. So this might be governors or chiefs or ethnic leaders, or warlords, or regional strongmen, whatever the case may be. That's nice because there's already these pre-existing clientelist networks you should draw upon. You don't have to build extensive grassroots party organizations. So, but among the set of patrons that you might use to organize this type of clientelist exchange, employers, we think, are a very effective mobilizer of votes for several reasons. One, employers are uniquely well positioned to hand out significant positive and negative inducements, right? So employers can threaten to fire voters if they don't vote the way that they promised, or they can promise them raises and extra bonuses or what have you. Also, employers like those parties that are embedded potentially in people's social networks might find it easy to monitor voters' voting behavior. People's social networks are embedded in their place of work, and employers can find out through their subordinates potentially how people voted. And also there's repeated interaction with management. So employers know that if they violate this vote-buying contracts, that they might be punished in the future, and presumably they don't want to keep their jobs under most conditions, and that makes promises of future inducements credible. Also, it's worth noting that countries vary significantly in the extent to which different types of patrons exist. You know, some countries there might be strong locally based ethnic leaders, other countries there might be strong governors or caciques, but in every country people go to work. So I think this is a potentially quite general form of voter mobilization in these types of regimes. Okay, so workplace mobilization might make sense. So what it doesn't, or it might make sense for an autocrat to engage this type of mobilization, doesn't actually take place. So we've done some surveys, or we've piggybacked on some surveys in Russia around the 2011 and 2012 elections, and asked some questions about the extent of this practice in Russia. And so I'll just start here with some of the general questions we've asked. So we've asked employed individuals, did your employer try to influence your decision to vote? 1 in 4 Russians said that their employer tried to influence their decision to vote the 2011 elections. That's a question that focused specifically on inducing them to turn out. Did your employer try to influence your choice of party? A lower number said that they tried to influence their choice of party. This kind of makes sense that turnout mobilization or inducing voters to turn out would be more prevalent than inducing voters to vote for a specific party, because it's much easier, as we'll talk about in a second, to monitor voters' decisions to turn out than it is to monitor who exactly voters voted for. We also have some specific questions about the specific types of work-based political activity that took place during the election. So did the director of your firm endorse to the candidate? 15% did. Campaign events. In Russia, many of you might know, there is a cultural aspect here, right? The workplace in the Soviet period was highly politicized. This is where, to the extent that there was election campaigning in the Soviet period, this is where it took place. And this cultural practice has carried over into the post-Soviet period, post-Soviet elections. Firms frequently hold campaign events, get out the vote drives, allow candidates the opportunity to come and speak to voters in the workplace. I'll mention it here. We're going to come back to it in a second. We also, after the 2011 elections, did a survey of firm directors and asked them about the types of political activities that they engage in the workplace. And you get similar results. 1 in 4 said that they engage in some type of political activity. We didn't ask some of the more sensitive questions about, that you'll see in a second, that we asked the voters about the types of workplace mobilization that were carried out to the firm directors. We didn't, reasons maybe I can discuss the Q&A. We didn't have the possibility to do that then. We're hoping to do that when we do some more, another firm survey this fall. Okay, so these are rather general questions. You know, did your employer try to influence your decision to vote? Did the employer try to influence in some way your choice of party? We're also interested in exactly how they're trying to influence voters in the workplace. These questions, let me look at this. Yeah, so these are actually not our questions. In typical Russian survey style, these long, convoluted questions that the polling agencies had placed on these surveys, not us. But they did ask about specifically about threats and coercion in the workplace. So did your employer coerce or apply pressure on you? 7% in 2011. 5% reported coercion or pressure in 2012. So this one combines turnout, mobilization, and also inducements to vote a certain way. You see that this is a general trend that we see that the workplace mobilization seems to have been less pervasive in the 2012 elections than it was in the 2011 elections.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how well-defined the concept of employer would be in the Russian context? I mean, so this is from a generic...
So that's a good question.
People. I mean, imagine there's a big informal economy. I don't know what percent of the people even have an official firm they're working for, and if that's even the person they consider to be their employer.
Right. So, I have a really short answer, a really long answer. I'll give you the short answer. Well, the short answer is for these surveys, the polling companies, they ask some questions at the beginning of the survey. What is your primary place of employment? And then they only ask these questions to people who answer that question. So they're not asking these questions to people who are unemployed or pensioners. People might often have multiple places of employment, obviously, and they're often employed in the informal sector. So if they're employed in the informal sector, they don't, only in the informal sector, they're not going to even enter into this sample. But the part of the longer answer that maybe we'll get to more in Q&A is this is exactly what we're dealing with in the latest round of surveys we're doing, is looking, we're specifically interested in this, is how this practice varies in the formal and informal sector. If it's more, because on the one hand, I'll get to it a bit, on the one hand, you might expect that this would be less likely in the informal sector, right? Because in the informal sector, in the informal sector, employers might be less dependent on the state. But at the same time, employees in the informal sector, they have a lot fewer legal protections than do employees in the formal sector. So it's not clear what this will look like in the informal sector at this point.
But it would be much less efficient from the incumbent's perspective to try to follow them. The problem with the informal sector, one of them is their tiny, inefficient, widely dispersed enterprises. Or these
right. Will be that's exactly right. That's right, yeah.
John, this last question is, I'm not sure the percentage of respondents who just weren't paying attention.
What's that?
So the last question is, I'm not sure the percentage of respondents who just weren't paying attention.
What do you mean?
That just waited from voting for Pusin.
Oh, right. Yeah. Right. Oh, sorry, I didn't mention it. Yeah, so this would be, you know, these two together, right, so this one up here doesn't specify what type of pressure they put on you, whether it's to vote for Putin or not for Putin. And you know, this one is pressure for Putin, and this is presumably, I guess, if you believe it, people who are pressured by someone who supports the opposition. Okay. So these are somewhat low percentages, I think. You can imagine potentially that people might not want to reveal whether they have been pressured by their employers during the elections. And so we've done in these surveys and other surveys, we've done a series of what are called list experiments to try to elicit more truthful answers to these questions about negative coercion or about coercion by employers. So the way, I won't get deep into this, but in brief, the way a list experiment works is you divide the survey sample into a control group and one or more treatment groups, and each group is asked a question such as, how many of the following things have happened to you in the past 2 months? And you ask the respondent only to tell you how many of those things had happened to them. You don't ask them to tell you which one had happened to them. You just say, give me a count of how many of these things occurred. And then the control group, or all groups, are given a list of innocuous, we would call them items that we don't really care about in the survey. We don't care about any of these items. But then the treatment group, if there's more than one treatment group, you also add an item that is the sensitive item that you're interested in. So in this case, in this list experiment, we're interested in both vote buying, that is positive inducements, and negative coercion. And under randomization assumptions, you would expect that across if no one had experienced vote buying, or in this example, had experienced coercion, you'd expect the mean number of responses across all three groups to be equal. But to the extent that the number of responses in a treatment group is higher, again, under randomization assumptions, we conclude that that's the percentage of people who are choosing in their head this fifth option, the sensitive item. So the results here are interesting. What we're finding, and this is consistent with some other survey data I'll show you in a second, is that there's not a ton of vote buying going on in the Russian workplace. Rather, to the extent that this practice is happening, it appears to be that it's coercion or negative pressure. So the difference between these means is about 8%. So what this indicates is that about, although you know, it's only statistically significant at the 10% level, but approximately 8%. Of those who are employed were reporting that they face negative pressure in the workplace. So that's higher, somewhat, than the direct questions here. I'm not really sure whether it justifies it. On the one hand, you could interpret that as saying, well, this isn't all that sensitive to the Russian respondent because the numbers are similar. or nonetheless. But another thing to point out is that the differences are much higher for people between the difference between the treatment group with the negative sensitive item, the negative inducement sensitive item, and the control group is much higher for employed people. So 14%, yeah, I should mention that, so 14% of employed people are responding that they experience some sort of coercion in the workplace. 8% total said that someone in a position of authority had said there would be negative consequences for them if they didn't vote.
Now, the second treatment seems to be clearly turnout mobilization.
Yeah.
The first treatment, or we do interpret that as turnout mobilization or vote responding.
That, you know, I think that's a problem with me back translating. If I look at the Russian, and this is, in Russian, this is it's made much more clear that it's a material inducement for turning out. So it's a bit of a puzzle that there's not so much vote buying in Russia. And one reason here's a direct question. Again, poorly formulated, not our question, but it's on the survey. And in that question, about 2% of voters said that that their employers had, or 2% of employed people, no, this would have been for the full sample, because it would have been given the full sample. So it's, did you encounter attempts by the authorities or the management of your firm or other institution to offer your material rewards? So 2% of Russian voters are saying they encountered some vote buying offer. Something that's a little bit puzzling. These questions are a little bit difficult to interpret, but when you ask people, are you ready to sell your vote in the elections, you get a pretty big chunk of the population that says they won't sell their vote. So add that up, about what, 19% of Russian voters are ready to sell their votes in the elections. But here's a key point, I think. Russian voters are pretty greedy. They want a lot of money in comparative perspective for their votes. Usually, when you know, talk about the amounts they're using vote buying in places like Sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America, it's a smaller number. It's $5, $10, something like that. 10% of Russians want to, more than $30. 14% want more than $30 for a vote. From a comparative perspective, this disjunction is interesting as well. I mean, research on Africa finds that vote buying is much more common than negative coercion. So does research on Latin America and Central America. In Russia, we tend to find the opposite, both in the survey evidence and in anecdotal evidence, that there's more negative coercion and there's more negative inducements than positive inducements. A couple quick survey questions that we have that tap into the monitoring side of this. So, the presumption is that employers somehow discover whether or how people voted. Well, it's quite easy to find out whether people voted. In fact, with lots of anecdotes of firm directors who dispatch a supervisor to the polling place just to check off the names of people and find out if they arrived at the polling place. About 5% of polling places in Russia are actually in enterprises, so that makes it very easy to monitor the voting behavior of those employees.
John, there's absentee voting that takes place in enterprises as well.
Well, absentee voting.
Is that sort of?
Well, what do you mean? Absentee voting can take place anywhere.
But isn't it often organized at the enterprise?
I'm not sure. Well,
if the polling place is.
Okay.
If the polling place is in the enterprise, that might be where you get your absentee ballot, but otherwise you can get it.
I've heard stories about it. Large numbers of employees vote absentee and then they fill out their ballot and then it goes.
Yeah, well, the way that, I mean,
is there a monitoring mechanism?
Yeah, well, okay, I think you're referring to the so-called carousels. So you have an absentee ballot. Mm-hmm. It's filled out for you. So some organizer of the vote stealing process fills out the ballot for you, this absentee ballot, gives it to you. You go into the polling place, whether it's in an enterprise or anywhere else, I think. And then you hand in that, you get a blank ballot, it's your ballot, go into the voting booth, drop the filled in absentee ballot in the voting box in then come back out with blank ballots so that the process swaps.
Yeah, that's not quite about it. Anyway, that's...
Anyway, but not... So, so it's easy for them to monitor turnout, but a lot of employees in Russia also think that their employer could find out actually who they voted for. So about one in four employees think that that their employer could find out how they voted if they wanted to. That was in the 2012 elections. So we did another list experiment to get at the mechanisms of how that works. So you hear a lot of the anecdotes about directors forcing their employees to take cell phone pictures of their ballots. And I think that's probably an extreme practice, although maybe not. This list experiment, the treatment, the sensitive item we asked, whether people were required to report to someone after the fact that you voted or about who you voted for. And again, it's, you know, it's only significant at the 10% level, but it's about a 7% difference here. So potentially 7% of voters said that they had to report to someone about how they voted after the fact. For employed people, that difference is a little bit bigger. 11% of employed people reported that they had to report how they voted after the fact, or that they voted.
How big is your sample again?
So this would be here, it would be 800 in each group, 1600 total, roundabout.
Sorry, can you say 800 employed and 800 unemployed, or what do you mean by in each group?
No, the employed sample would be small. The employed sample would end up being about 1,000, so that should be, under if they stratified it appropriately, which I think that it would be about 500 in each sample, just among employed.
And do you have distinctions in firm size?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that in a second. Yeah. So something you might be interested in leading us into the rest of the talk about where this happens and where it doesn't. As you might expect, this is going back to that original question, that general question, did your employer attempt to influence your decision to vote? And this seems to be more common. There seems to be more workplace mobilization in government agencies and state enterprises, and less in private enterprises and NGOs. We don't have data on, in these surveys, on what particular state agency they work for, so that's the best we can do with government employees.
Is Election Day a holiday in Russia?
I'm sorry?
Is Election Day a holiday?
It's on Sunday. But that's our, well, an aside, this is often how polling places end up in the workplace, because employers that have to be open on Sundays, so some enterprises, they have 24-hour shifts, you know, and if you have to be open on Sunday, then the firm director can get a special dispensation to have a polling place set up in the workplace. And this is where actually, in the anecdotes, this is where you hear about a lot of the pressure in those types of enterprises. Okay, so where is this? So it seems to be taking place in Russia. So why does it happen in some settings and not in others? That's what I want to talk about for the rest of the time today. So as I said before, we developed this kind of simple argument that's based upon two dependent interactions. One, workers being dependent on management, and they're, say more about this in a second, but you can imagine that workers that are more dependent on management, they're going to be more vulnerable to these inducements. Then there's another relationship that merits saying a little bit more about, and that's the relationship between firm directors and the autocratic or the leader. And so let me say a little bit more about that. You can imagine that there are costs and benefits to firm directors of mobilizing votes in the workplace. So the benefits are pretty clear, I think. It puts you in the good graces of the states. You might then receive more subsidies or more state contracts. You might be exempt from regulatory sanction that you would otherwise be subject to. But there's also costs, I think. First of all, this requires time and effort, and if you're taking time away from economic activity to engage in political activity, that might have a negative effect on firm output. It also might have a negative effect on workplace morale to the extent that people find this practice odious. And also, of course, for the firm manager himself, if he doesn't agree with this practice, it might violate his own ideological principles. So there are, I think, some costs. So quite simply, you just might think, well, firm managers are going to do this when the benefits outweigh the costs. So you'd expect it to happen in firms that value highly the benefits of the relations with the state. That's the benefit side. And it might be more likely in firms that can mobilize voters more cost effectively. That is, firms where employees are dependent on management or there are economies of scale that I'll talk about in a second. So some empirical propositions that kind of come out of this simple framework. State-owned firms are obviously heavily dependent on the state. And so that we would expect that you would see more workplace mobilization of state-owned firms. Firms and sectors characterized by immobile assets, that is, immobile assets that are highly vulnerable to potentially expropriation or more likely, regulatory sanction, because it's very difficult for firm owners to move those assets to other jurisdictions. They're more dependent on autocrats, so these types of firms would be more likely to mobilize, I think. Firms that sell to the state, obviously more dependent on the state, and firms that receive support from the state, subsidies, organizational support, that type of thing. As for the costs of mobilizing employees, well, we think that firms that provide their employees with non-wage benefits would be more likely to mobilize workers. The reasoning behind this is that when employees receive not just their wages, but also potentially social provision from their employer, losing that employment might be much more catastrophic for them. This might be, we're interested in this in the cross-national context, where this might not be as important in the cross-national context, but in the Russian context, it's quite important, we think, because in the Soviet period, social provision was organized at the level of enterprises, and it was offered in kind, right? So firms handed out, or firms organized healthcare and vacation facilities and educational opportunities for their employees. And a lot of this in-kind, often informal, social provision carried over to the post-Soviet period. It is starting to die out now, but even as late as 2011, firms still provide a lot of this type, fill the gaps on social provision. And so for employees that receive a lot of these non-wage benefits, we think they'll be more likely to be dependent on their employers, more likely, therefore, to be targeted with these inducements. Next, employees that don't have viable exit options, that is, that if they do lose their job because they're not voting the way the management wants them to, if they don't have outside employment opportunities, that's going to be losing their job is going to be catastrophic for them, so they're likely to be more vulnerable to these types of inducements. Finally, there's economies of scale as well, right? So for any given mobilizational activity, just holding a campaign event or transporting voters to the polls, putting them all in a bus, the marginal cost goes down with each additional voter that you're trying to mobilize, right? So we would expect that large firms would be more likely to mobilize workers. It's worth pointing out that that prediction is not, it's slightly inconsistent with what we might expect in the existing literature, which predicts that this type of clientless exchange would be more likely in small-scale settings where it's easier to monitor the behavior of voters.
And that difference really arises from the fact that you're focused more on turnout mobilization than you are on vote buying.
That's a good point, yeah. Well, that's true, although at the same time, the cost of inducing people to vote a certain way and then monitoring them, that's going to go up in large firms, but you're still going to have the economies of scale
of organizing that effort, I think.
And probably not only the size of the farm would matter, but the size of like, what is the farm, what is the small locality. Even if it's not a big farm, if this is the main employer, then we'll have much more leverage on the workers.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk about that. So that's all the same on. It's not necessarily the size of the firm, it would be the size of the plant. Mm-hmm. So you could have, for instance, retail, for example, is not easy right. to mobilize in general because it's it could have tons of employees, but they're at small locations all over the place, whereas a single large steel plant may not have as many employees, but they're all in one place.
That's a good point, yeah.
When you say firm, you mean enterprise, or do you?
So, we mean enterprise. I mean,
what's the distinction?
Yeah,
so I'm thinking about like our measure of the size of the firm, it's the number. I'll have to look back at what the actual question is. But I think actually, no. Actually, I think in our surveys, it asked them how many people work at your location or in your filial, right? So I think So I think the questions we're using, it's not about how many people work for Megaform, it's how many people work in your filial. Because they wouldn't know. Of course, it's because they don't know how many people work in, you know, the coil or something.
Where was the survey? Is it only in Moscow, or where was it?
Oh, no. It's a nationally for the voters, it's a nationally representative survey. I'll talk about the firm survey in a second, but for the voters, it's nationally representative. So it's just the omnibus surveys that Levada does. It's nothing special.
Okay.
And lastly, you can expect firm directors to support the ruling party be more likely to mobilize workers. The ideological costs that end up doing so are lower. So on the point of the survey, so the population survey, that's a survey of the voters, national representative survey. We also haven't talked a lot about it yet, but we also put questions on a firm survey that was carried out in just before and just after the 2011 elections. And that was a survey of 922 firms in 15 regions. So that is, there's a number of different regions. I mean, so not just in Moscow or in large regions. And so these were surveys with the top managers, CEOs, CFOs, and these folks. Just a quick bit about the data. So that for the voter survey, it's that question that I've talked about before. This question here about turnout mobilization, did your employer try to influence your decision to vote? I should say a lot of the results are similar for one. Another question that we're interested in is what explains the choice to engage in turnout buying versus vote buying, turnout mobilization versus vote mobilization. A lot of our results, we haven't made a lot of progress on that because a lot of the results are the same for these two, but because of the lower number of people reporting vote buying, a few of the results don't have as large a standard. For the firm survey, it's a dummy variable equal to one if the firm engaged in one of these following political activities: endorse a candidate, allow a party to hold events, distribute party materials, invite workers to vote for the party, invite them to join the party. So I'll talk about kind of the measurements for the independent variables, but mostly straightforward with a couple of exceptions that I'll talk about. So before control mention, we control for previous turnout propensity. For the firm survey models, control for some characteristics of the director as well. Okay, the results. So So we are finding, this is from the firm survey, workplace mobilization is more likely in large firms, about twice as likely in firms with 600 employees or enterprises, let's say plants, than they are in enterprises with 10 employees. Firms that provide non-wage benefits to their employees are more likely, it's not a large difference, but are more likely to engage in workplace mobilization. Firms in heavy industry, so that's firms that are characterized by mobile assets, We can talk about the other sectoral variables. But in general, we're finding firms in sectors characterized by mobile assets are more likely to mobilize. Firms themselves in the state, more likely to mobilize. State-owned enterprises, more likely to mobilize. Should mention, well, I think I forgot to mention, this is, these aren't bivariate, this is from a multivariate logit model. And firms that receive state support, again, not a huge difference, but are more likely to mobilize. Okay, from the population survey, I will draw this. Again, larger employers more likely to mobilize. In the employer survey, we didn't have great measures of employee dependence on their employers. Especially, we didn't have measures of types of benefits they receive from their employers. But what we did look at was whether or not they worked in a firm that was located in a company town, or what they call Russian monogras. So these are cities where the Russian federal government compiles a list of cities where one enterprise or set of interlinked enterprises constitutes is an employer to more than 50% of employed people. I can't remember the exact way they measure. But as you can imagine, people who live in these towns, to the extent that they, if they work for these employers, their exit options are limited. If they lose their job, there's not other employers in that city. There are a few other employers in that city where they could get a job. So we would expect them to be more dependent on their employers, more vulnerable to these inducements. And that's what you end up finding, is that this practice is more likely in single company towns and in monogamies. And we find the same thing about asset immobility. Firms in sectors characterized by mobile assets, heavy industry, the natural resources sector, more likely to engage this type of behavior.
You get unemployment at the regional level or something?
Well, we did have, so we had a question about, so we don't, you know, I'm just laying out the sausage, I'm not sure what to make it. We had a question about asking people how long they thought it would take for them to find a job if they lost their job. And it doesn't do anything. It's a strange variable to begin with. Most people think it will only take a week. It's very few people think. Yeah.
I was just had a thought about the gold mine. To what extent it would make sense for gold mine to be more appealing for people who are in marginal groups, whether unemployed
right.
or in like marginal ethnic groups. Like in Bulgaria, for instance, it's usually among the Roma that all the gold mining happens. So to that extent, I don't know whether these questions were, whether those who are unemployed answered differently with regard to gold.
So that's my suspicion as well, is it just related to income? Because we also find that this type of behavior in firms is not related to income, which is a bit of a controversial finding, because there's one finding in the vote buying literature, it's that poor voters are more likely to be targeted with vote buying offers. But we're not finding that this type of activity is targeted more at poor voters. I suspect what's going on is that Russia's a middle-income country, and most voters are priced, it's too expensive to offer them enough money to induce them to vote. And the numbers in the surveys, we know there is vote buying. We have anecdotal evidence of vote buying going on in Russia, but the numbers in the surveys of people reporting vote buying are too small for us to analyze in a systematic way. So just concluding really quickly, so a couple of the implications here. So. For those who are interested in the study of clientelism, I think there's a couple of implications here. Well, one, this type of clients exchange could be brokered by firm management and not just by parties or ethnic leaders, as has been studied in the literature thus far. We're finding more, as I just mentioned, more evidence of negative inducements than we are positive inducements. And relatedly, it seems like if this type of clients exchange is brokered in the workplace, it might persist in modern industrial settings, where most of the literature on clientelism expects that this type of practice will die out once countries modernize and industrialize. Also, as you might guess, there are probably implications here for how we think about the economic basis of democratization. So I think this, you know, tells us something about why we see economic and political liberalization go hand in hand. There's lots of reasons why that might be the case, but one reason is that when the state controls a lot of enterprises, controls a lot of the economy, finds it easier to mobilize voters. And at the same time, this, perspective provides some of the micro logic for why we might see, or a different perspective on why we might see countries with economies that are characterized by immobile assets being less likely to democratize. Less likely to democratize. Just to conclude. So, as I said, this is kind of this exact analysis that I presented, something we did almost a year and a half ago now. So we're kind of moving on to new questions and using this survey data, and some of the descriptive data I showed you is kind of what we're trying to start analyzing today or right now. And a couple of the questions that we're interested in, I'd be interested to hear your perspective on, is one is how do leaders monitor the vote by mobilizing behavior of firms? So we kind of went through a lot of the ways that firm managers monitor the voting behavior of their employees, but then you could also, the autocrat has to figure out which firms are complying with its directive to mobilize votes. We haven't started analyzing this yet, but you would expect, I think, right, that this also might be another reason you would see this happening in single company towns, because in those instances, the precincts are going to correspond with a single or a small set of employers. So it's going to be easier to see whether employers are putting forth the vote mobilizing effort. We also see, I didn't talk a lot about it, but we also see some party-based mobilization going on in Russia, including some party-based clientelism, which is a bit surprising. But we see both going on. So another interesting question is, when do autocrats choose to engage in firm-based mobilization versus party-based mobilization? I suspect it's going to have something to do with the strength of the organizational strength of political parties. And that does vary somewhat at the regional level in Russia, so that's something we're trying to analyze. What are the consequences of this practice? Clearly, autocrats want this. They want this process to help them win elections. But we're also finding some evidence that especially the most coercive varieties of this practice also tend to produce a backlash and might actually make people stop voting for the ruling party in subsequent elections. We have some panel data that seems to be indicating that. And also, we want to see what this practice looks like in other countries. We have lots of anecdotal evidence of it actually happening in other countries, although it seems to happen in a very different way, and the informal sector plays a much bigger role in a lot of other developing countries than it does in Russia. And one question is what this practice looks like in the informal sector. So thank you for listening, and I look forward to your questions.
All right, well, pretty informal here, so you can probably just call on people as you see fit.
Okay.
People can introduce themselves if they like.
Yes.
I have a question. So I don't know whether I'm correct in that, but it seems that your assumption is that this kind of behavior is happening in authoritarian regimes, but not in democracies. Well, I would suggest that at least in some democracies, maybe. Or to truly understand is happening. It's not only happening in private firms, might also be engaging in it. And what I have in mind is case in Bulgaria, for instance, where I have an example from voting, but from cases in which companies, private companies, are forcing their employees to go to pro-government demonstrations because the government is under a lot of pressure to resign.
Yeah.
So these companies are sometimes, they're private companies, sometimes they're bankrolling parties which are in the government. So it's not necessarily, in some cases they might be expecting to receive something from the government, but in other cases they want the government to stay in power because they have an interest in particular politicians and parties. So
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, even in the United States, I mean, you all probably won't follow this like we were since we were interested in this topic, but during the 2012 elections, there were a couple stories in the media that came out where employers sent emails to their employees saying, well, if a certain candidate, I won't say which one, doesn't win, I'm going to have to fire you all. They weren't saying, I'm going to fire you all. They didn't explicitly say, I'm monitoring your voting behavior and I'm going to fire specifically you if you don't vote for this candidate. But it's
one of these firms was in Milwaukee.
I'm sorry?
One of these firms was in Milwaukee.
I'm not saying. But yeah, but so, well, the question there, come back to your specific question in a second. The question there, right, in cases like that is does that subvert the electoral process? And this has been something that's actually been debated by legal scholars in the United States, whether the inherent asymmetries in the employer-employee relationship are such that any type of mobilization by employers should be considered implicitly coercive. That's a normative. Well, that's a question that straddles the line between empirical and normative research, right? So. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I think it does happen in democracies as well. I think it probably happens less just because it isn't necessarily a feature of democracies, a feature of liberal democracies, but workers in democracies tend to have more robust legal protections than they do in autocracies. Maybe that's my supposition, and that may be wrong, but I suspect it's more common in autocracies for that reason.
Yeah, I think this is interesting, and I guess I had a couple of comments. One is, I think in terms of context, the Soviet legacy of pressure on voting in firms is just absent from your presentation. I mean, you said at the beginning the workplace was somewhat politicized in the past, and I would say
more than somewhat, yeah.
It's not just somewhat politicized. The political system 100% controlled the economic system,
yeah.
And they organized voting very strictly for the Communist Party. And I mean, it's like any older person in Russia would have experience of having been coerced into voting for communists in the workplace. So that's an absolute habit, and the control system of party officials. And the other thing is the connection between party officials and firm managers. So in this party versus firm-based mobilization, to me, the question is, how many firm managers are part of United Russia? How many are part of, or whatever is the governing party of the day? Like since 1991, any of the parties of power, how many managers were part? I mean, so you can't, it's hard to separate out. Is it party or firm-based mobilization if the firm managers are party members? So I think that's a kind of critical question. And I guess as I think, my thinking is, okay, where are you going to have firm-based mobilization? You're going to have it in any state-owned firm, in any like Norilsk or any region like that where they're totally dependent on one firm, which is totally dependent on a relationship with the state.
Right.
Universities, I mean, would be similar situation to that, that are not firms, but they would be in the same situation. Like, is the small business owner going to necessarily pressure their three employees? No, because that's a completely different thing. Because a small business owner is not just this legacy of the Soviet past, but like, in Uralmash, are they going to be doing this? Like, almost certainly. Because who is going to be directing those firms other than, in the current environment, other than people who are members of the party? So I guess I think a little bit more of that context would situate what the findings are. But the other thing is that I think in terms of the voter responses, one, people are very conspiratorial, if I could make a generalization, I think people in Russia are very conspiratorial. So if you say, does your employer know who you voted for? People
yeah.
are like, well, yeah, probably, because, they, like, and does the CIA know who I voted for? Yeah, like, maybe they know, too. So people overestimate the level of surveillance and confidence of the government all the time, right? So they're going to expect that people, know stuff about them. And So I don't know. I think there's that's a factor, I think, in asking people about whether they think they're being monitored. I think that's going to be a factor. I would expect them to overestimate their level of monitoring.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people think that somehow it is known whether or not they voted. I mean,
right.
Even I know relatively liberal people who have a kind of fear if you don't vote, they will know you did not vote. Even if they're going to vote against the governing party, they somehow feel somebody's going to know I didn't vote. And that's, again, a communist thing of that you had to vote.
Right.
So I think a little bit more of the background. And then I don't know that I would draw as a conclusion from this something about immobile assets versus just the overall number of ways in which firms may be dependent on the state. So it could be because of size, it could be because of location, it could be because of industry sector. There's like, you can think of a bunch of factors which is going to make a firm dependent in some way on the state, and those are the ones that are going to be have the mechanisms in place to put pressure on firms and have the connections to the party.
Great. Yeah, so the first thing, so I'll make it, so the legacy thing, I think you're exactly right. In fact, your comment could be even more injurious to our approach than you might suspect in a comparative perspective, right? Because, well, on the one hand, I think you're exactly right. So then the puzzle becomes, why did it stop in some firms and carry on in others? And I think
yeah.
the reason that it could carry on in others is a lot of the reason, or in some, is for the, you know, the reasons we lay out here that you also articulated. You know, some firms remain controlled by the state, and some had close relations with the state. But in comparative perspective, it might be the case that this is really just a post-Soviet phenomenon. That's kind of our first order of business is to have surveys in other countries. It might be our post-communist phenomenon, specifically because of the uniqueness of that relationship between the firm and the party in communist countries. So all we have right now is anecdotal evidence from other countries, and you see it, but we don't know how widespread it is yet. The party versus firm overlap. I can tell you exactly how many. In the firm surveys, 3% are actual members of United Russia. About 30-something percent supported United Russia. So that might be lower than you might suspect. So I don't think there's perfect overlap between people who are formally associated with the party and who are mobilizing. You're right. But of course also right that this is something that's in my book that the directors of large firms that are owned by the state, firms that have immobile assets, they're the ones that are more likely to, that their directors are more likely to be members of United Russia. But, you know, that's why we have multivariate analysis. The ballot secrecy, yeah, you're exactly right. In fact, right, there's research on the United States, something like 30% of people don't think that the ballot secret in the United States, right? So something's wrong there. Moreover, what you find in Russia is that people who vote for the opposition are much more likely to think the ballot's not secret. So I'm not sure, and I don't even think we're going to use those ballot secrecy questions in analyses, because I think what's going on there is you have people, you know, who they're already oppositional to Putin, so they're more attuned to these type of things, right? And so they read news about workplace globalization, and yeah, my employer is spying on me. So I'm not sure how useful those questions are. I have a little bit, to the extent that the differences between the treatment control group and the list experiment about reporting to your employer are statistically significant, they're borderline, but to the extent those can be believed, I think that's a little bit different, because that's asking about specific action that you take to inform your employer or someone in a position of authority. And you see the differences there, right? It was 11% of employed people said they had to report to their employer, but the 23% say that they think their employer knows how to do it. The immobile assets point. These firms with immobile assets often tend to be, so oftentimes they're state-owned, they sell to the state, but they're not so perfectly correlated that there's not perfect multicollinearity. So, you know, that's why we hold constant these other factors. And then
the multi-unit setting to see if having immobile assets has a partial effect on site mobilization.
Yeah, I just have a question. Could you please be a little bit more explicit about who's making the decision to mobilize? So I'm just sort of wondering what the train of logic is. Is that, so does an autocrat in a region say we want X, Y, and Z firms to mobilize, or is it going to be that we want, or do the firm leaders just based on their history, their legacy of being a big firm that has always been mobilizing people, is it implicit or is it explicit that they have to mobilize?
So, I mean, to be honest, it's slightly both. The explicit part, you know, this is another question that we're interested in asking firm directors in our next round of firm surveys, more explicit questions about the type of directives they might receive from political authorities. So, absent systematic evidence, all I can offer is kind of, you know, what the anecdotal evidence tells us about how some of this goes on. So, I'll give you one anecdote. You know, there was a famous, during the elections, there was a famous video leaked onto YouTube, the mayor of Lipovitznetsk, maybe you're familiar with this, where he's talking to a gathering of the city's largest enterprises and giving them directives. Okay, we have, you know, United Russia needs to get this many votes in this election. He's not telling them you need to force people to vote, but, you know, the message is clear. United Russia needs to get this many votes. You're all responsible. Adults, you know, maybe what needs to be done next. You hear these anecdotes about these type of gatherings. So, Greg Olson, he did a trip around the regions right before the elections. Peculiarly, he was meeting with the heads of directors, even though this isn't in his normal portfolio of political responsibilities for the Kremlin. He was going around meeting with the heads of firms in all the regions right before the elections, press reports indicated that that's what he's meeting them about, telling them what the plank should be for United Russia in the elections. But, you know, reading a little bit more into your question, I think there is also part of that exchange that maybe potentially some employers think, well, if I mobilize, then that might get, they don't receive any directive, but if they think, well, if I mobilize, then that might put me in the embrace of the state to translate into benefits for me.